All right. In preparing for this message today, I actually looked for some little notebooks. There used to be these black vinyl notebooks from the late 1960s, early 70s through the 70s that my father kept as all of his sermons were in those notebooks. And I looked for them and I couldn't find them. And I was a little disappointed, but I should have asked my wife, that's true. But you know, I just have to look at it and say, all right, God didn't want me to go that direction, but I did run across all these cassette tapes, and the cassette tapes, there were just boxes and boxes of them, and I was thinking, where do I have a cassette player? and so I don't know. I'll have to look at that stuff, but I look at the heritage that I have, and I look at it with eyes wide open. It's not a perfect heritage. I don't think anybody has that. I'm not saying the people are perfect, but I do see, and I recall as a kid, even the song, I Surrender All. I was thinking about that this morning as we were singing it. In the 1970s, I was, you know, growing up in the 80s, and here it is, you know, being in Pompano Beach, Florida, at Pompano Baptist Temple, and I'm 5 years old, and I remember that song. That was an easy one that I could remember to sing. And I kept thinking as a little kid, surrender, surrender. It's just, you know, I got three older brothers. I surrender to them all the time, you know, as a kid. But as time went on, that song stuck in my mind. And I just see God work through those things, just a song that a child remembers. But I also see songs that are old to a lot of the young people in here, but they're new to me still. And I see every song this morning that I was just, I don't know, I'm looking at it at a different way than I used to look at it, or a deeper way, I should say. Every one of those songs are exclusive. They're exclusive to one God. They can't be in the Catholic Church that serves more than one God, to where they have other deities. It's exclusive. I see the song, what is it, Cornerstone? Tremble at His voice, or tremble at His name. What is the line? Tremble at His voice. And I look at that, and I see fear. In fear, we're not supposed to fear things, are we? I don't know, the Bible's kind of conflicting on that at first glance. One of the areas that I started reading in, and I find when I read the scriptures, I'll read and I'll go there and like, I'm going to keep on going. And there's so much that we can learn about. One of the, in different scriptures, we see that it says, fear not, right? There's so many scriptures that say that. But then it says to fear God. It's like, well, wait a minute, which one is it? Which one is it? Now, I read through Genesis chapter 42, and I do plan to read chapter 42. So have a seat, stay a while. Proverbs 28:14. It says, happy is the man that feareth alway. Like, well, that's kind of a miserable state of being from a simple-minded approach, right? But there's context to it. But then we have another verse, 1 John 4:18. There is no fear in love. It's like, okay, come on, guys. this doesn't make sense. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casteth out fear, and because fear hath torment, he that feareth is not made perfect in love. Now, when we look at the definition of the old English dictionaries, since the new ones are so wrong in so many ways with their definitions. The definition from Webster's Dictionary, the old one, is fear is an unpleasant, often strong emotion caused by anticipation or awareness of danger. It's anxious concern, profound reverence and awe, especially toward God. Reason for alarm. Charles Spurgeon, he explains that John and Solomon are both right with the two kinds of fear, is what it comes down to. There's two categories in general of fear. And so it's not a conflict. They're both right. The first type of fear would be torment. And it's a fear of what's coming, that awareness of danger, or just the concern or thinking about what could go wrong or what could legitimately happen, or it's imagined. It's still fear, no matter what, if it's a viable fear. But it's also, as Charles Spurgeon said, he said it's a slavish fear. And I really appreciate that label on it, because we are slaves to it if that type of fear is what drives us. And we've heard from Pastor Ray so many times that he says it in different ways, but it's basically when we're making decisions based on fear, we're not making good decisions. And the torment type of fear, is where, just like the song we were singing moments ago, trembles before God. And if it's a slavish fear that we're unbelievers, right? Then we're a slave to what God could do to us in terms of punishment, and it's an unknown to us. Now, for a believer, the song we were singing, it's not slavish fear, and we'll get to that in a moment. The slavish fear is a mistrust. If we trust God, we're not having a slavish fear experience, are we? We don't have to suspect what God might do to us because we don't have that relationship. A slavish fear is one where people have no confidence in God because they have no relationship. So let's look at Genesis 42. And what I want you to think about as we go through this, because there's all different types of things that we could approach in here, but Genesis 42, I want you to just kind of count in your mind how many things, how many fears are expressed in chapter 42. Now, by the way, just to think about this, here it is. We've got the story about Jacob's sons and how he that they went out and they got jealous of the youngest brother at that point. Or the younger brother. What was his name? Anybody remember? What's that? Joseph, that's right. And so what happened was they got fed up with him and they threw him in a pit and then they were going to leave him to die and then they turned around and like, yeah, let's get some cash out of this deal, and they sold him for a slave. And then, not good news, because as things progressed, he ended up going, serving, and applying the godly principles that he knew to apply, and then he became favored, and then God allowed that to be all taken away from him again with a false accusation, and then he ends up in prison. And then he has these dreams, the same dreams that got him in trouble with his brothers, but the dreams that he turned around and he was able to tell Pharaoh's give him an understanding of what his dreams meant, and that sprung him out of jail. And then he got a high office, and God just really brought him up through the Egyptian government. And here he is, not an Egyptian. But that's all the kind of the backstory. Now, when we get to chapter 42, here's his family back home. His father thinks, Joseph's gone. He's done. He's dead. And then there's a famine. But there's one place that has a lot of food because God ordained all of this, right? There's a lot of food. And so they're starving. They're kind of frightened by what's going to happen here. So chapter 42, now when Jacob saw that there was corn in Egypt, Jacob said unto his sons, why do ye look one upon another? And he said, behold, I have heard that there is corn in Egypt. Get you down thither and buy for us from thence that we may live and not die. Well, that's practical, right? But that is a fear. And Joseph's 10 brothers went down to buy corn in Egypt. But Benjamin, Joseph's brother Jacob, sent not with his brethren, for he said, lest peradventure mischief befall him. And the sons of Israel came to buy corn among those that came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. And Joseph was a governor over the land, and it was that sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brethren came and bowed down themselves before him, their faces to the earth. Now that is another type of fear, right? That type of fear is respect for authority. This guy had the authority to do anything he wanted. If he didn't want to sell him the corn and said, go on your way, or he just didn't like him and, hey, you're dead, or you're in prison. So they had fear for that authority. And Joseph saw his brethren, and he knew them, but made himself strange unto them and spake roughly unto them. And he said unto them, whence come ye? And they said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. And Joseph knew his brethren, but they knew him not. They didn't recognize him. And Joseph remembered the dreams which he dreamed of them, and said unto them, ye are spies, to see the nakedness of the land ye are come. And they said unto him, nay, my lord, but to buy food are thy servants come. We are all one man's sons. We are true men. Thy servants are no spies. Man, they're fearful right now, right? This is not going the right direction. And he said unto them, nay, but to see the nakedness of the land ye are come. So he accuses them again. And they said, thy servants are 12 brethren, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is not. Who are they talking about? One is not. They think Joseph's dead, gone. And Joseph said unto them, that is it that I spake unto you, saying, ye are spies. Hereby ye shall be proved. By the life of Pharaoh, ye shall not go forth hence, except your youngest brother come hither. Send one of you, and let him fetch your brother, and he shall be kept in prison, that your words may be proved, whether there be any truth in you, or else by the life of Pharaoh, surely ye are spies. And he put them all together into ward 3 days. And Joseph said unto them the third day, this do and live, for I fear God. Now he's got that reverential fear, the fear that a believer has. And if ye be true men, let one of your brethren be bound in the house of your prison. Go ye, carry corn for the famine of your houses. But bring your youngest brother unto me, so shall your words be verified, and ye shall not die. And they did so. And they said one to another, we are verily guilty concerning our brother. Now they're fearful, right? And they're starting to express verbally amongst themselves, we know why this is happening. And we don't know what's going to happen to us, but it's not looking good. We are verily guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us, and we would not hear. Therefore is this distress come upon us. And Reuben answered them, saying, spake I not unto you, saying, do not sin against the child, and ye would not hear? He's basically saying, I didn't do it. I wasn't involved in this. But he was. Therefore, behold, also his blood is required. And they knew not that Joseph understood them, for he spake unto them by an interpreter. But he could understand his language growing up. And he turned himself about from them and wept and returned to them again and communed with them and took from them Simeon, one of the brothers, and bound him before their eyes. Then Joseph commanded to fill their sacks with corn and restore every man's money into his sack. This is a part we don't want to miss here. So they came with payments for corn, and they were going to pay that and then turn around and go back home. So this is key. They put the money back in with the food to give them. Okay, so then Joseph commanded to fill their sacks with corn and restore every man's money into his sack and to give them provision for the way, and thus he did unto them. And they laded their asses with the corn and departed thence. And as one of them opened his sack to give his ass provender in the inn, he espied his money. For behold, it was in his sack's mouth. And he said unto his brethren, my money is restored, and lo, it is even in my sack. And their heart failed them. There's that fear kicking in again, right? And they were afraid, saying one to another, what is this that God hath done to us? They're not necessarily believers of God or followers of God or adhering to him, but they're fearing who he is and what he might do. They just don't have that relationship. And they came unto Jacob, their father, unto the land of Canaan, and told him that befell unto them, saying, the man who is the lord of the land spake roughly to us and took us for spies in the country of the country. And we said unto him, we are true men, we are no spies. We be 12 brethren, sons of our father. One is not, and the youngest is this day with our father in the land of Canaan. And so it goes on, and they explain what happened. And the father's heart is sinking. Because guess what? He's got another son that didn't come back. So his trust is in God. But this is not a good situation. And he got a weak point, which we all hit. And Joseph said in verse 36, me have ye bereaved of my children. Joseph is not, meaning I've already lost him, and now Simeon is not, and now Benjamin is going to be taken away from me. So he's fearing. Now, he's whining as well, because I know this, I do this. It says, all things are against me. Well, that's not a true statement. He's a believer. But that is a point of weakness for him. So the brothers, when you think about it, they're all living in sorrow, but they're living in fear, a slavish fear. And when you think about that, is that you? Is that somebody you know that has a slavish fear? Because they are dealing with so many unknowns. Jonathan Edwards exposed the preacher of a few hundred years ago. He exposed the cultural Christians of his time. We've got them today, right? The cultural Christians. I went to church when I was little, and I know all the right things to say, but are they Christ followers? But the cultural Christians he was exposing at the time and revealed how they're fearing. And he went aggressively after this. And there was one particular church assembly that he went to in, I think it was Enfield, Connecticut, that was known to really just be, you know, that country club type church that just didn't have that fear of God. And he preached the sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Anybody ever read that sermon? Okay, that's intense. He laid it all out. He didn't hold back anything. Here's some quotes from that. They are already under the sentence of condemnation to hell, speaking of those who don't really know Christ but are playing church. They are already under a sentence of condemnation to hell. They do not only justly deserve to be cast down thither, but the sentence of God is gone out against them. Your wickedness makes you, as it were, heavy as lead. You ever held anything that was lead? like fishing weights. Okay, it's a little thing, but man, you can really feel it. And gold is about the same thing. If you feel a big piece of gold, and you're like, wow, so it's so heavy. It's a different sense when you're holding on to that. So he used that illustration. Your wickedness makes you as it were heavy as lead, and to tend downwards with great weight and pressure towards hell. And if God should let you go, you would immediately sink. I think he was pretty clear. I mean, he's throwing all he's got. He wants to convert them to a holy fear, not a slavish fear. He wants them to leave the slavish fear to that second category, the pure category, the right category, the holy fear. So let's jump to Psalm 112:7. It says, he shall not be afraid of evil tidings. His heart is fixed, trusting in the Lord. Well, there's your definition of holy fear. Reverential fear is another word we can say for holy fear. It's what the holy angels feel when they worship God. Do you notice in the scriptures it says that the angels actually have a veil or use their wings to cover their faces? Because that is respect. That's reverential. They also have a gracious fear. The seraphim, the way they cover their faces before God. A loving fear. Now, how can a loving fear, that seems so contradictory, right? A loving fear. But think about it. It's that loving fear of maybe a child in regards to their father. They're fearful to step out of line. Yes, they know consequences. But they love the father, even though the father has to correct them, has to punish them, has to train them. And it's harsh sometimes, and it hurts. But there's still a love there. Because they know ultimately that father's intent is pure. It's right. And then you think about that fear of disappointment. I don't want to disappoint my father. I never did want to disappoint my father. I strived for my earthly father, for him to be pleased with me. He died last year. It's been a year, and he's in heaven now. And I look back so many times, how many things drove me to perform in a way that I did so I could please my father, even when I was 25, 30. I was out of the house. I was married. I had kids, 40 years old, 50 years old, still trying to please my father. Now, you know, I've heard that in a negative context so many times. Oh, you're just trying. You're controlled by your father or your parents, or you should be free of that. That's not a bad thing. It is not a bad thing at all. But it's a picture of the way we should be with God. If we have a holy fear, we have a desire not to disappoint him, a fear of disappointing him. That should be in the category, it is in the category, of what holy fear is. You know, it's amazing how many temptations there are to pull us away from God. And when you look at it, if you put it on a scale, and I'm going to just tell you the scale of my personal experience, the scale of temptations versus the things out there that are compelling us to righteousness. What are the heaviest ones? What are the loudest ones? It's always the temptations. They're just heavy, and there's just seemingly, it just seems like, where's the weight over here? I have to press down on the scale over here. How do I press down on the scale? I press down on the scale here to tip it the other way by having that holy fear. Well, how do I get holy fear? there's elements that are guaranteed to be required to get to that point of holy fear. If you don't have these, you're not on the path to getting that holy fear. If you're not reading your scripture on a regular basis, I promise you, you are not on that path for holy fear. If you're not in prayer on a regular basis, I promise you, these are elements that are absolutely necessary to grasp and experience holy fear. Pray without ceasing. We've heard that, right? We've read that. It is important to know that when I share these things, I don't share these things as if I've mastered them all. That would be dishonest. That's just not true. My kids can tell you, my wife can tell you. But pray without ceasing. Take that time to pray. How many of you wake up in the middle of the night sometimes and you're just like, I'm awake now. What do I do? It's a good time to pray. And I've just come to the point that when I wake up, like woke up early this morning and I'm just in bed, I'm like, this is comfortable. I'm not wanting to get out. And that's a time to pray. I'm not trying to say I'm holy, I've got it all figured out. But you know what? Yesterday I was working on some stuff in the afternoon and I picked up a car part because that's what I do to relax. I don't go golf. I don't go hunting. I work on cars. And so I was picking this thing up, this car that has parts that are just so hard to find. If one needs to be replaced or whatever, there, a lot of them are just not available. And this part was so small but so important. And I picked up the part and I'm like, it's gone. It's missing. Come on, this is going to take so much work. There's not even a part number for this part. And it was a whole assembly. You can't get the assembly. Haven't been able to get the assembly for 20 years. Blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm thinking all these things. I'm like, Lord, help. I can't find this thing. I'm on the floor. I've got my flashlight out. I'm going through. My battery's dying on my phone, which is my flashlight. And so I'm like, ah, come on. And I'm going through, and I'm looking through, and I'm crawling around in dust and dirt and everything. And I'm like, Lord, I'm not gonna fret about this. Just show me what to do, and I just probably need to clean up my whole work area anyways. And so I'm cleaning up, and then I go on to something else, some other parts. I'm like, well, I want to get something assembled here, and on this rainy day. And then I walk past this one pile of stuff, and like kind of it's like my miscellaneous pile of, I didn't mark that when I took it off the car, all these nuts and bolts and stuff. And I go there, and I'm like, There it is. Thank you, Lord. It's such a minor example of always be praying when you're dealing with it. Calling a client, I know they're not happy about things. I know I don't have a good answer for them, and I don't like that call. Lord, help. I don't want to disappoint anybody. I always want to have the right answer for them. It doesn't work that way. And so I called them, but the whole time the phone's ringing, and before I even called, I'm like, all right, Lord, just guide me, and please work in this situation. This is not an audible, prayer. These are just quick little prayers. It's, if we can get to that point, I know there is, a closeness that is being built, a pursuit of that holy fear. It's all key elements. You know, one of the things to look for is the holy fear includes a fear of what have I done to put barriers in between myself and God? What have I done? And always seeking of, was I honest with what I said there? Was I honest with dealing with this person? Was my tone harsh there? Was it unnecessary? Minor things like that. Is there a thought that there was a temptation out there and it triggered a thought? Okay, What did I do with that thought? Did I go further with that thought? Well, now I fell to that temptation thinking about it. Or did I, Lord help, I don't need to be thinking about that. I need to focus on the right thing. Is that how I'm functioning? Do I have a fear of disappointing God? Do I have a fear of putting barriers between myself and God? There have been points in my life, personally, that the barriers were so great, I couldn't even count them. I couldn't even identify them. I couldn't even go back because I was so far from God for so long. But God will help clear those things. God's made a way. It's real simple. I don't have to go to a priest. I don't have to go to another person necessarily unless I need to make things right. I can simply go to my knees and pray, God, forgive me. And help me understand and recognize what it was that caused these barriers. What are those barriers? I want to be as specific as I can to tear down each one of these barriers. So the person that is, the believer that is really pursuing a holy fear, there is a constant searching for conscious and unconscious sins. Sins of omissions and sins of commission. There's also, have you ever been around somebody to where, wow, this person really has a real holy fear, so healthy, such a vibrant person in God, but they have that holy fear? Have you ever met a person like that? Can you think of anybody right now? And you look at that and you realize, I think this way, God's provided that person as an example to me. I'm seeing God reflected through that person. It is very evident when a person has a true, legitimate, holy fear. That person knows they can fall anytime. Psalm 139, verse 23, 24. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. And see if there be any wicked way in me. And lead me in the way everlasting. That's a constant theme of the person that is pursuing God. Genesis 43. Let's go back to Genesis. I'll tell you what, Genesis is actually an amazingly interesting book. I think there's so many sermons in there that you could, if you're a preacher, you could spend a lifetime preaching just from Genesis. There's just so much in there. When you look at 43:10, you see a godly, wise father, not perfect, but a godly, wise father. And 11, actually. He got to a point of saying, hey, if we got to do this, let's do it. And let's go back and, yes, you can take Benjamin. And he made the decision because he said, hey, we're running out of food again. We need to go back. You need to go back. And so he gave a directive, and he said, listen and obey. And that's what the sons were doing. This was a turning point for a lot of the sons. When you think about it, the turning point is your conversion. It begins by taking responsibility of your own sin, owning your own sin. Not excuses, but own it and confess it. And then turn. Turning is obeying and starting to go the right direction, right? That's going the right direction. Staying on the narrow road that leads to God. So the brothers return to Egypt with little brother Benjamin. And Joseph, here it is. They see him. It all goes well. And then they're set up again, right? But this time they put it in Benjamin's bag. Joseph puts his own personal silver cup into Benjamin's bag. So it looks like Benjamin himself got handsy with the shiny cup. Which cups back then, guys, that was it right there. I mean, it was your clothes and the cup. If you had a cup, you were something. And if it was made of a fine metal like silver, it was something. It wasn't just a plain silver cup. This thing probably was adorned with all sorts of engravings, and it was very, very special. Well, Joseph arranged it to where it looked like Benjamin had to have that cup and snatched it and put it in his bag. Well, that's not what happened, but Joseph put it in there. So they're going back, and then all of a sudden, boom, they get snagged and said, hey, somebody stole this cup. And here it is. Uh-oh. And now the brothers, they're freaking out, right? Because they're realizing, not Benjamin. No. This is the one that our father is wanting to protect. Not him above all of us. So the brothers return because they've been accused of stealing. So look at Genesis 44. It's the test. And now we're not going to read through all of it. But it's a turning point for the brothers collectively. They've been self-focused. And they got a whole bunch of barriers they put between themselves and God. If they're believers. Or if not, they're just sinners anyways. They're lost. Now they're focusing on what's right. And concerned about disappointing their father, Jacob. Fear-based decisions are no longer how they're functioning. Brothers fear the possible consequences of what the authority is going to do to them. It's a good fear. Think about it. Authority, where does it all come from? Where did it all originate from? God. Mosaic law. That's what our whole country runs off of. Yeah, we've got imperfect people delivering that. There's abuses of law, yes. But when you look at the law as its entirety, it is a beautiful thing, even though it's run by imperfect people. So here it is. The brothers return back to Egypt, and they're trying to right the wrong, but this time they're making no excuses. I noticed that. No excuses this time. We didn't do that. We didn't put that in there. We did. Now Judah, one of the brothers, what he did, and this is key, we don't want to miss this, he insisted that he takes Benjamin's punishment. Now, what is that a picture of? That's right. It's a picture of what Christ did for us. He's taken the punishment, but he stepped up boldly. Now, think about it. Judah's looking at this going, I would rather be punished, be a slave, lose my life, than to go back and disappoint my father. That is a picture of holy fear. Now, I think about this too, and I think God obviously sees everything. Joseph heard that when Judah was saying, take me. I believe Joseph, his heart was thrilled at that point because he knew that's the action, that's the evidence that they have turned their hearts the right way. I believe God was thrilled at that point because he knew, yep, it's time. That's what's happening right here. It's a picture of holy fear, without a doubt. So when we look at chapter 45 of Genesis, we're not going to read all of that, but I'll just tell you this. It's a picture of turning away from sin. You know what? I'm going to tell you something that's, I don't know why it matters. When I read this, I actually started to cry yesterday. I'm not going to cry today. Let's read it. chapter 45. Look at the redemption here. If you've been lost and you've been redeemed, forgiven, it can't be any better than that. That's what this is. It's a redemption. Then Joseph could not refrain himself before all them that stood by him, and he cried, "Cause every man to go out from me," he said. And there stood no man with him, while Joseph made himself known unto his brethren. This was a time that he said, "Hey, this is who I am, guys." And he wept out loud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard. And Joseph said unto his brethren, "I am Joseph." Now think about it. They've not heard this guy speak in their language, but the first words that they've heard from him, "I am Joseph. Doth my father yet live?" Again, he's thinking about his father. And his brethren could not answer him, for they were troubled at his presence. And Joseph said unto his brethren, "Come near to me, I pray you." And they came near. And he said, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom ye sold into Egypt. Now therefore be not grieved, nor angry with yourselves." Wow. He doesn't even slow down to let them say, "Let this sink in, guys, because this is not good." He just said, "You're forgiven, guys. It's done." Now, he did explain that ye sold me hither, for God did send me before you to preserve life. He gets the big picture. He gets the God shot, the God's view of what the whole plan was. "For these 2 years hath the famine been in the land, and yet there are 5 years in the which there shall neither be earing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you that sent me hither, but God. And he hath made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. Haste ye and go up to my father and say unto him, Thus saith thy son Joseph, God hath made me lord of all Egypt. Come down unto me, tarry not." All their problems are solved right there. They're not going to be stuck in a land to where they don't have any food. But look at this, the way Joseph was looking at it. He was looking at it as the big picture. He stopped looking at himself. That is so hard for us, isn't it? Stop looking at yourself. Look at what God might be doing in this situation. That is a constant effort. Stop looking at myself and look at what is God doing. "And thou shalt dwell in the land of Goshen, and thou shalt be near unto me, thou and thy children." Hey, this guy's the boss, right? And he's your brother? That's a pretty good setup. "And thy children and thy children's children and thy flocks and thy herds and all that thou hast, and there will I nourish thee, for yet there are 5 years of famine, lest thou and thy household and all that thou hast come to poverty. And behold, your eyes see, and the eyes of my brother Benjamin, that it is my mouth that speaketh unto you. And ye shall tell my father of all my glory in Egypt and of all that ye have seen, and ye shall haste and bring down my father hither. And he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept. And Benjamin wept upon his neck. Moreover, he kissed all his brethren and wept upon them. And after that, his brethren talked with him. And the fame thereof was heard in Pharaoh's house, saying, Joseph's brethren are come. And it pleased Pharaoh well and his servants. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, Say unto thy brethren, This do ye, lade your beasts and go get you unto the land of Canaan, and take your father and your households and come unto me, and I will give you the good of the land of Egypt, and ye shall eat the fat of the land. It goes on and on and on. This is better than the lottery. They've hit it all. It's redemption, folks. It is amazing. What a great story. And there's other stories of redemption in the scriptures, but it's a powerful one. It's a one of ending conflicts and getting a whole new start. If you've ever been in a situation, and I have, if you've ever been in a situation where I can't believe I got myself into this situation, Lord, I really made a poor choice. Help. And his resolution is not always mine, but if I get to that point of, doesn't matter what your solution is, God, I'm in. I take the consequences and I move forward, but knowing that God loves me regardless. You fall down, you get knocked down, whatever it is, God wants you to get up and pursue him again and not stay down. Satan wants you to stay down. Think about the guilty criminal that he's fearing the judge. He's in front of the judge. The evidence has all been laid out. The jury has said, you're guilty. Now the judge has to do the sentencing. They're fearful of what that is because they know, I can't even argue this. They got all the evidence, everything. Witnesses, video, everything. They're guilty. I'm guilty. And then turning to that point, the other extreme, to where somebody steps in and says, I'm going to take the punishment. It's hard to even grasp. I'm going to take the punishment for this guy over here. So he changes from that fear that tormented him, that enslaved him, to a fear that is freedom and is joyful, and knowing this guy, this Jesus, the Christ, he has saved me. I'll do anything for him. The penalty's been paid. I'll finish with this. If we can put away the tormenting fear and pursue the holy fear, we all want to do that, yes. But remember, it can't happen without that constant prayer, that attitude of constant prayer. It cannot happen if we have barriers in our way because we haven't confessed them, we haven't gotten that sin out of our lives. But it can't happen without first repenting, turning from our sin, turning physically, spiritually, getting away, aggressively getting away from what we've been doing in our lives, turning away from that sin and making that change. Think about it, folks. We've heard about the wide path of the world, right? It's well traveled. And that narrow path, the problem is those paths, a lot of times, they get kind of close, the edges of them, right? And we try to, like, okay, I'm in this path. I'm going to just kind of, I walk funny now, but I'm trying to do both paths because I'm straddling it, not God's plan. We've got to go to that other side of the narrow path and say, I just want to be away from that wide path. I fear falling back into that, and that's a holy fear. So let's think about the difference between being a slave to a tormenting fear or being a happy slave and having a holy fear. Let's all pray. Father, thank you for the privilege of just knowing that we are being heard by you. Knowing that throughout this globe that there are many people praying to you right now at different places. There's gatherings of believers praying to you. And Lord, yet you can hear us all. And you know our hearts. Lord, thank you for loving us. Thank you for writing your word down. Thank you for giving us the understanding of what it has. Thank you for all the mysteries in there that we haven't yet understood, but that we can dig in and explore. Father, I pray that we really focus in for the rest of our days of leaving that slavish, tormenting fear behind us into where the holy fear becomes so natural to us that we can't function outside of a holy fear. That we have that joy of knowing we're close to you and that we don't want to disappoint you. And that it becomes who we are. Lord, I pray this not just for the people here that's hearing this, but especially for myself. And I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.